Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host, and thank you for joining us today. Today, we have a very different kind of guest. I'm very excited to have Jennifer Brown joining us. Jennifer is an award-winning entrepreneur, speaker, and diversity inclusion expert. She is the founder, president, and CEO of Jennifer Brown Consulting, which is a strategic leadership consulting firm on diversity that coaches business leaders worldwide on the critical issues of talent and workplace strategy. She is really passionate and she advocates for social equality to people in the LGBT community, people of color, women, millennials. She is all about trying to help male leaders understand the importance of inclusion and diversity. She's been featured in so many different outlets, the New York Times, Forbes, the Wall Street Journal, Fox News. And she's been named Social Entrepreneur of the Year by the NYC National Association of Women's Owners and much, much more. She is currently the author of a new book, Diversity, The New Workplace and the Will to Change, Advantage Media. You should check out her book. You should definitely check out this episode. Jennifer is awesome. I just really enjoyed my conversation with her. She's super easy to chat with, but she had so much incredible information to share and a very different perspective than many of the guests that we've had on the show. If you're interested in diversity, if you're interested in thinking about change in companies and things that you can just think about in your own life, then tune in and enjoy today's show. Thank you so much for listening. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I have Jennifer Brown joining us from New York. Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
Hey, Laura. Hey, good to be here. Thanks. I'm good.
We just had our first chat pre-recording, and we both decided that we needed a coffee in New York because we could have chatted for an hour. It's really great to meet
you. Indeed. Like kindred spirits.
Yeah. I just think you have so many cool things. I'm so excited to chat. Before we maybe... So you've written a book, Inclusion, and you've got a consulting business, and I want to hear all about that. But I was really taken by your backstory. Would you mind walking us through a little bit? You were an opera singer before moving into the idea of inclusion in the workplace. How did you go from opera singer to the place you're in, and how do you connect the dots for yourself? I thought that the story you told was just really amazing. I don't want to steal it, though.
Yes. If you want to hear a little surprise on that front, you can watch my TEDx Presidio talk. I gave a TED 5 years ago, and there's a little goodie at the beginning of it that will, I think, delight your listeners. It's a quick talk, but I'll jump into the story kind of midstream to answer your question. My opera days sort of came to an end, and I'll leave that as a surprise for those that are going to watch the talk. But you know, in short, I wasn't really able to sing anymore. And due to that, it, you know, it was problems with my voice, et cetera. And I had to literally reinvent and literally refine my voice and rebuild my voice. But also it was a huge wake up call to, I think, strive for greater authenticity, as you say, and alignment in my life. And as I did that, I followed the advice of many people who said, you know, you'd be really great as a corporate trainer. And I didn't know what corporate training was. I didn't know it was a field and a career for many people. And I looked into it, and I ended up being really good at it. I got a second master's degree after my first, which was in voice, a second master's degree in organizational development and leadership. And it was just, I felt like the work felt all about human potential. It felt very heart-centered. It felt altruistic. It felt like I could make an impact in the world in a way and utilize, you know, everything about me, my story, who I am, what I know how to do, my instincts and intuition, my, you know, what would become my technical knowledge around becoming a consultant. So it just was like a very lucky place to find myself. And mechanically, how I reinvented from a career perspective is I delivered programs as an independent consultant, what we call soft skills training. I did that for a couple of years, had some internal HR roles as an employee in organizations, which you would all know the names of. And then I incorporated my business. I became an LLC 10 years ago. And I started it all by continuing to do soft skills, but for bigger and bigger clients. But then the other piece of the story is that I'm also a member of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community, the LGBT community. And I've been out since I was 22. And I was always kind of watching that I was leading these parallel lives, I guess, like between who I was personally and the kind of business persona that I had. And as I started to pivot into this training space, I was very active in a lot of pro bono work relating to the LGBT community in the workplace, and had a lot of friends here in New York who were at Merrill Lynch and Deloitte, and they were out and they were kind of pushing their companies along in terms of equality of policies and benefits and practices. And I saw for the first time how change really happens around how people would be using their voice and influencing their employer. And then I kind of tapped into eventually this whole community of passionate people, both employees, but also, you know, change agent consultants like myself who are nudging these organizations along and kind of teaching them as we go about how to embrace all kinds of diversity in their workforce, how to capitalize on a diversifying marketplace. And one thing led to another, and I started to kind of reorient my company away from general leadership soft skills to more diversity and inclusion consulting and training. And that just was such, for obvious reasons, it was such a fit for me, and it allowed me to bring more of my full self to my work every day, meaning that I could be, you know, part of my expertise is actually who I am and the life that I've lived. And
that's the point that I heard in that video that I thought was so powerful, that your voice was taken as an opera singer. You were no longer able to sing, but then you realized, hey, there's more to having a voice. It's just my voice into the world, right? And how can I bring that forward? And your supposition is if you're not bringing your full self forward, right, it's detrimental to your work output. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. So the research I always point to, and your listeners should look it up, it's free online. It's called Uncovering Talent, and it was a report done by Deloitte. And it talks about this concept of covering, which means that all of us walk around downplaying or hiding aspects of who we are that are really our truths, you know, whether that's our socioeconomic background or cultural background or sexual orientation, or maybe we're downplaying our gender, you know, if we're a woman in a man's world, and the way we dress or wear our hair or the way we speak. I mean, everybody does it to a certain degree. And even, you know, the white guys report covering in the research as well. So it's very inclusive, the research, which is what I really like about it, because it's not something that just women and people of color and gay people know something about and people with disabilities know about. It's really human. And it's these humans kind of bumping up against these organizations that aren't really built to embrace the full individual and are not flexible to kind of shape around that person. And so we all end up kind of, you know, managing and putting energy towards what we're hiding or downplaying that we think is going to be stigmatized. And as I don't need to say, you know, diversity is really very poor in so many companies, especially the higher up you get when you look at the org charts. And so there's many, many people, especially in the lower and medium levels, that are looking around and saying, I can't bring my full self to work because I don't see anyone that looks like me that's been rewarded for that and that's been promoted and that the company is extolling as this is what a leader looks like. And so, you know, then we have the problems of retention that we see where people just leave companies, you know, women still leave companies at a faster rate and people of color spin out. And, you know, you don't see any openly gay CEOs in the Fortune 500, except for Tim Cook at Apple. So it's a real problem. And I think we've got to reconcile the organization with the individual.
I love that you say that it takes away some of your energy, right? Because I haven't really heard anybody put it that way. In my own personal experience, you know, I ran my own company and I was hanging out with my brother running a company. So you'd think, well, God, if there's any place that you can just fully be yourself. But in truth, because it was like a very healthcare tech business and people were very buttoned up and it was very conservative, I ended up selling out a lot of who I was. I tried to fit that mold. And just to your point, years later, I left and my brother started another company. He said, hey, can you be on the board so I can get some banking stuff done and just show up to this banking meeting? And I had so moved away from hiding the different elements of myself and trying to fit in that I went to this banking meeting and I literally couldn't play the role anymore. Like we were in the 50th floor of Chase in like a room with a marble table. And I was supposed to like sound very serious with the banker, but I just don't care. So I was like, hey, and I was like more jokey and relaxed. And my brother kept looking at me like, what's wrong with you? You know? But I think I'm a better person when I'm like that. It's like, that's who I am. And that's where I function better. But there is so much pressure to fit into this very narrow mold. And I love that you say even the white guys are trying to to I guess, give up on some piece. Because then it's like, well, then who are we imitating exactly?
Yeah, exactly. If it's broken, why are we trying to be like that? You know, but everyone has so much to lose. And I think especially, I think maybe white and male leaders might believe they have the most to lose, you know, because they're at the top of the heap. And I spend a lot of energy coaching that echelon of organizations and talking to them and really trying to, unfortunately, convince around the power and the benefits of diversity to them, you know, the benefit to them as leaders of becoming maybe vulnerable to their own diversity story, to examining, are they in alignment every day? You know, how unhappy are they? You know, but the straitjacket that especially men, I think, are put in or put themselves in, and that the business world sort of rewards, is, I don't think, healthy for probably anyone. And yet it's, I don't think it's very well understood the toll that it takes, because we do focus mostly on, you know, women struggling with, you know, balance or career advancement, et cetera. Uh-huh. Or, you know, we have been talking to ourselves for a really long time, and I'm getting kind of, that's all very well-worn territory for me. Like, I can talk about it all day long about diverse talent. But what really fascinates me, though, is how do we bring in a new contingent into this conversation and help people to really care? And I think, you know, the conversation after the election is spurring a lot of people to action who might have thought, well, I can sit by, you know, diversity and inclusion is just going to happen. You know, it's sort of, you know, there's a lot of belief that it's sort of this inexorable progress, that it's just going to progress. You know, it's change is coming, and, you know,
it's not those people that have like tirelessly worked at it.
Yeah.
So when you say you work with these individuals, particularly at the top, to educate and show them, can you explain some of the things that you walk through? And when you say that even for them, they're not fully happy or actualized, I think like a lot of people are like, come on, the top of a company, they've got to be like, they've got the plane, they've got to be really happy. Right. And I mean, I know that that's not true, but can you walk through like the types of things that you see and some of the suggestions that you offer?
Yeah. You know, one out of every 10 or 20 board members or management teams at a given company, they will be your champion, you know, whether that's overt or sort of covert, and they're identified, you know, before you go into the conversation by the head of HR, for example, and they'll sort of lay it out for you, and they'll say, so this one is super duper gets it. The CEO's on board. He's like holding everybody accountable for, you know, improving our organization. And then you've got the laggards, you know, the ones that are resisting, and then everybody in the middle. And it's important. I was trained as a consultant, and I love kind of meeting the client where they're at. And that means meeting the person and the leader where they're at. And everybody is different. There's the company, there's the team, and there's the individual. And each one of those things can be a very different challenge that you need to tackle in a different way. So you work with the early adopters in a different way of encouraging them to speak to their peers and influence, like use their power and their platform to influence, especially other men. So men influencing other men is actually it's a powerful and very underutilized mechanism for change around diversity and inclusion, because they're going to listen to each other in a very different way. In the same way that I'm listened to differently because I'm a white woman talking about diversity, it's interesting that some colleagues of color will say, can you come in and have the conversation that I've been having, but I need them to hear it from you and listen to the way that you talk about it, because potentially there's a comfort level based on ethnicity.
Yep.
That's true. You know, it's not true if I'm a woman walking into a group of men, right? Then we are different, right? And that's a little bit hazardous. You have to navigate that.
It, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's almost like if you're a woman walking into a room full of men, they're almost doing you a favor by listening. But if you're seeing each other as similar, like two men talking, it's more of a balanced relationship from the get-go. Is that,
I mean, sadly, it's really credibility. I mean, I think women are still second-class citizens, and we're very underrepresented as business minds and as thought leaders and as forces to be reckoned with. And, you know, you and I were chatting, you know, I go into Barnes & Noble and I look at who's writing business books on leadership, and it's 90% male authors.
Yeah.
And you look at Harvard's, all of Harvard's airport guides around all these like fundamental concepts, leadership, delegation, motivation, it's all men talking about it. And so, you know, there's a project called the Op-Ed Project that actually takes women and trains them to write op-eds, because 90% of the major op-eds in papers and media are written by men. So all of the, if you think about the, it's just,
what do you mean trains them? Because they don't know how to write in a style that people are responding to?
I don't think it's a style thing. I think it's a confidence thing. It's a confidence thing and kind of preparing your point of view. I think we may have points of view as women. Of course we do, you know, but it's packaging it and putting it out there strongly and being savvy about how you express yourself. And honestly, though, I think confidence is the biggest factor that women have to get over, the hurdle of saying, my opinion doesn't matter, what's yours, or being a great listener when we should be talkers.
Right, you know, or couching, like, I write for some business journals, and I see the guys say, this is how to do it.
Yeah. You're like, oh.
I wrote a piece about management and the 12 rules of management that I saw. And my friend is a guy who's, you know, amazing. And he helped me with a title, and he's like, the undisputable 12 laws of management. And I'm like, oh, you know, cause as a woman, like, undisputable, like, that's such a strong statement. And he's like,
can we say that?
And he's like, laws. He changed it to undisputable 12 laws of management. I'm like, wow. But I don't think we, like, you know, feel, I think there is, it's a confidence, and also just women don't interact and speak that way with each other even.
No, it's really conditioned. It's conditioned in us, and then we continue to perpetuate it. And I think the fact that we don't see a lot of role models doing it differently also holds us back. And I think it's in our written communications too. You know, I regularly listen to myself speaking and make sure I am choosing the strongest possible words, that I am saying the non-words are eradicated from how I speak. And, you know, there, Amy Cuddy, I think, does this really amazing work on power poses. You know, that just inhabiting the space, our body language communicates to others whether we are a force to be reckoned with, whether we belong there, whether we should be listened to. And it's not just what's coming out of our mouth. It's our volume of voice. It's the eye contact. It's our stance. It's how we use gestures in our body and space. It's, you know, how we sit in a chair.
And
it's
all of that
really
flies in the face of what we perceive feminine to look like, you know,
I personally, I feel very feminine when I inhabit that power. And that's, I think we need to explore that more, because yes, it might be assumed that those things are traditionally masculine, but I almost feel like saying, I don't want those things to belong to men.
Right.
I mean, they don't.
And because it's learned at some point, women don't start crossing their legs a certain way and sitting a certain way when they're, you know, 10, that you sort of pick that up and start doing it. And guys cross their legs differently.
Yep. Man spreading. Hashtag.
So you found yourself working in this space, consulting, pushing the needle forward, being a voice for diversity, embracing diversity, for race, orientation. Then the book, Inclusion, happens. Why this book? Why now? Tell me the process in thinking about a book specifically.
I've wanted one forever. It was on my original strategic plan for my business from 10 years ago.
Oh my God. That's awesome.
Yeah, I know. It took me a long time. It took me way too long, I think. You know, it actually, interestingly, does have something to do with what we were just talking about, which is the whole readiness question for women. I'm sure that I fell prey to that. And I now know I have this book in me, and I could have written it earlier for sure, like years earlier.
Yeah.
However, you just have to decide you're going to do it. You need to line up the right team, which I did for the most part, but that's a longer story. You always learn, and the publishing world is a really frustrating one.
Yes.
For a lot of reasons.
It's a really complicated one because it's moving right now. It's all over the place.
You're right. Yeah. You are so right. You're so right. So I think, yes, I could have written it earlier. Funny enough, the timing, so I started writing it a year ago or so. The timing with the election is really interesting. There's no accidents, right? Mm-hmm. If I had written it a couple of years ago, the diversity and inclusion conversation has been building and crescendoing, but it hadn't really peaked in the way that it is peaking now. And I could not have predicted it. God knows I didn't want it to peak because of the reasons, for the reasons it's peaking. And yet, you know, I do believe that my voice needed to emerge in the way it did and at the time that it did for many, many reasons. And I've just been kind of watching it unfold. And when we, after the election, interestingly, so many corporate clients of mine had people just crying in their offices. I mean, they were just trying to hold their workforce together. And it was traumatic for so many people. And we had a webinar the next day. My team and I just said, we've got to provide a forum right now. We just have to. We've got to put a call out there, send it to our list, which has like 6,000 people on it. And we had 150 people jump on with 2 hours notice.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was incredible to kind of gather the community of, you know, change agents, as I call people that do what I do for inclusion, and just to hold each other and to breathe together and to not only talk about how traumatized we might have been as people and how scared we were feeling, but to then have to turn around and kind of help our workforces. And those are the people that we really, those are our clients, you know, that we represent, that we comfort, that we are there to understand and help. Yeah, it was a really like pivotal moment. And it just thrust us into, I think, way more significance. And I've known that, believe me, I have known that diversity and inclusion has been on fire in organizations for a long time. Right. But this kind of, you know, just raised the whole conversation to a different level.
Absolutely. And put a lot more intention behind it, would you say? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think, yes, and also caused a lot of us to say what we were wrong about, you know, a lot of us to acknowledge how limited our thinking has been.
How do you
perhaps
mean?
How? Well, I think we have not been properly inclusive. I'm not sure we've been walking the talk. And when I say we, I mean the people that specialize in this and write books about it. And I suspected, and looking back on my writing of the book, you can hear in the book very strongly, I think, that I am very focused on reaching the white, straight, male leader who may be picking up the book and saying, what is this diversity thing? You know, I'm skeptical about it, or is it a fad, or I don't have anything to say about it, or is it just, you know, compliance driven and, you know, just to kind of avoid lawsuits? I mean, and I literally, in the book, I call all those things out and I say, I take every single rationale and I say, actually, no, it's not this, and it's not that, and it's not that, and here's what it is instead. And it felt like a very much of a guiding star as I was writing it, because those are the people that we haven't engaged yet in the conversation. And to our detriment, we have not, I think we've been in the minority having sort of a choir conversation.
I see.
And we have not been engaging the majority. And this was before the election.
Interesting.
And then when the election happened, I think honestly, it put a huge sort of all this data behind the fact that we had sort of not dismissed, but I think not understood the role that all of us need to play in change. And that was a reminder for me, but I have to say, I've been thinking about it for a long time. And I have always been a bridge builder. I've always wanted to kind of leave the comfortable shores and say, go where the boat needs to take me and go to those islands and say, you know, how can we establish a connection if we have so many things that are different between us?
Yeah,
what can we find that's common? And I think that's going to be the work that needs to happen.
Because sadly, like the white male leader is mainly thinking about it from very frustrating compliance issue, not from a, you know, understanding and commitment to the bigger purpose.
And I
think the education. So when you're educating that person and helping them understand the purpose behind it, that gets them more on board with it, right? Otherwise, it just becomes bureaucratic.
Yeah, like another HR program.
Yeah,
you have to make a personal connection with people. Well, you have to. And or you can make an intellectual connection as well. There's so much data that is done by really reputable sources like McKinsey and Pew Research, and you know, all the think tanks can for days have documented what the workforce wants and the diversification of the workforce, right? So if you're trying to hire the best and brightest talent, you know, you need to not just talk the talk, but you really need to walk the talk as a leader and as an organization when it comes to inclusion, or you're going to lose a lot of valuable people because, you know, more and more, especially when you look at millennial values, diversity is one of their top five values. So when they come into an organization of any size, and they want to bring their full selves to work, if they are, they get those signals that they should go back in the closet, metaphorically speaking, or cover who they are, they are going to be quicker, I think, to not stick around for as long. I know you said you stayed somewhere for a really long time. Like, you know, the cycles are going to be really short, and we only have a very short window to make that impression about what we are about as a company and what I am about as a leader. If I want you to quote unquote follow me, how am I going to establish that followership? And that still is how business gets done. You know, we're still, unless we're all just a country of solopreneurs, we still need to do good in organizations, and, you know, structures are still relevant. Although, you know, companies like Zappos are taking them apart. And, you know, I think that we're seeing a lot of flattening of hierarchies in a lot of companies, which is cool to really see, because I think that's going to help elevate everybody's voice, I think, and bring that to the table. But back to your question, sort of what convinces them, it can be family stories. It can be personal stuff. It can be an intellectual argument around sales. You know, if we want to have the best and brightest to build the best products and sell the most widgets, who's buying those widgets? You know, it's a diverse world. It's a world that will be minority majority soon.
Yeah.
If it's not already, you know, in so many places in the millennial market, it certainly is. So, you know, any company that ignores this.
Instead of out of guilt or obligation or an HR bureaucratic thing or something, they feel like, oh my God, this is being pushed down my throat, which I think is unfortunately the view a lot of people have. It's look at the benefits and look at the outcomes that help you, help the company, help your business thrive. This isn't like some altruistic gesture.
No.
And then from there, they can start to hopefully appreciate the value of allowing people to show up in their full selves. While you're talking, it's making me think of Whole Foods. have you thought about like that company? You know, I'm always struck by how happy the cashier, the guy behind the deli. And do you think it's because they're allowed to show up with their piercings and tattoos? And has anybody studied that?
Yeah, you know, their CEO wrote a book called Conscious Capitalism.
Mm.
And I'm interested to get to know him. I don't know him, but it's the whole concept. I think they are pioneering. Does it really matter how you show up, when you show up? You know, certainly for retail, you know, you've got to show up on your shift and, you know, in a professional garb. But in the corporate world where I do a lot more work, you know, companies are virtualizing their workforces. I mean, they're really like companies like Cisco, who I work with, are work whenever, wherever, however you want to, as long as you get your work done. And, you know, here's all the technology you need to do it. And by the way, your role is global. So you've got to, you know, from a time zone perspective, it's a challenging way to work. And we all know these extreme jobs, right, that so many of us are working. But on the flip side, you can work as yourself, you know, and fit it around your life and fit your life around it. And so I think there's a lot of promise for diversity and bringing our full selves to work in this new world of work where we can express that. Now, I think the flip side, though, I write about this in the book. It's kind of a conundrum because on the other hand, in the physical workspace, when we all had to come to an office, we saw more maybe diversity with our coworkers than maybe we experienced in our communities, you know, at home and in our families. Like the workplace is the place where we were forced to have diverse teams. We were forced to kind of rub shoulders in the elevator and chat with people and have affinity groups, you know, who could have events and people could see leaders that looked like them, you know, in the flesh. So I think, I don't know where the diversity conversation is going to go as we virtualize more and more. And who knows, maybe there'll be a backlash and everybody will be called back to the physical office because, you know, somebody will determine that we've lost so much from a culture perspective that, you know, we're sort of like Marissa Mayer, you know, called back all the Yahoo employees, you know, when she took over, she brought everybody back. And I think that was because, you know, I'm probably for very real, like reasons of coordination, like who's doing what and what happened, you know, we got to get it back. But I think that
there's definitely a downside to this virtual business stuff I feel like everybody's focused on the upside of like, I can work in my pajamas and in a cafe. But you know, when you really start speaking to these people, they're disenfranchised. They're alone all the time. They don't have like a community. It can be very, very lonely.
Especially for young people. I think they may be struggling the most, which is counterintuitive, right? Because you think they would want that more than any other generation, but I've had 25-year-olds say, I make a point to go into the office. Like, and I'm trying to, you know, network with executives, but nobody's there because everyone's working virtually.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's a good point too. How do you network with the higher ups?
Right. How do you learn? Like, how do you learn what you need to know? I mean, my niece is going through this. She has a wonderful internship this summer at a think tank for women, and she's about 20 years old. And I said, so will you be working on site and getting to know all these like senior women researchers, rock stars? And she's like, no, well, my boss is in, you know, West Coast. My boss's boss is in the Midwest. My, you know, so there's like no reason for her to go in.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, how does this someone, you know, at that point learn what they need to learn? I mean, we really watched, we learned at the knee of, you know, I think about my four mothers, you know, and even lots of men, frankly, that I watched kind of operate and navigate and, you know, mentor me, you know, in person. And I think they're, I don't know how this is going to go. Honestly, I don't know.
Yeah. I've done both. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the flexibility of a virtual life,
too.
But you know, there's nothing also like having all of the team on the same floor and you can have like a quick meeting and a jump in a room and a powwow, like to get everybody on a phone and Slack or whatever. It just isn't, it's just
totally.
It's not the same, you know, there's just something about everybody sitting in a room and looking at each other in the face and solving problems together. I don't know. You feel more connected. I think it's just a more natural environment.
You totally do. And it's so tough because if you're an entrepreneur, it's so expensive. Like, to bring everybody together physically, to pay for office space. You know, I think we wouldn't have as many companies kind of growing up and becoming tomorrow's big companies, you know, if we had to have an office and have that infrastructure. You know, we've got to be light on our feet. And for me, that means being able to grab the best and brightest from all over the country. In fact, almost none of my team is in New York, which is where I sit. And so we live it every day. We're Skype, we're on Slack, we're on five different conference call lines. We have, so it's tricky, but I think my folks are happier because they get to have their life. And I also give them a lot of freedom to say, hey, I want to work on that. I don't want to work on that. I need to take the summer off. You know, we don't have to talk about employment agreements and things like that. So it's a really, we are absolutely kind of living the experiment of the edges of what works and what doesn't work with that new model.
So Jennifer, when I hear you talking about that, you know, on the one hand, I can imagine business leaders listening and thinking, well, that's just a lot of work to think about, you know, Sally's summer vacation and somebody else's. But like I was a business owner, and one thing I push back on all the time is like, that's where you're supposed to be working. That's where you're supposed to be spending your time is, you know, investing and understanding your employees. So many people just look at it as like work output. What do you say to the person who says, oh my God, seriously, I don't want to like get that invested in their stories and like deal with this many levels of complexity around what their needs are?
Oh yeah. Oh man. Yeah. It's been a trick. I mean, my senior team and I spent a whole lot of time vetting people and building the relationship slowly, you know, sort of one brick at a time with our team. And you know, getting to know, can we trust each other? Can we, what is your cadence of work? What is my cadence? What's important to you? What do you need to manage so that you have that family time that really fills you up and makes you happy and is so much a part of who you are? It's tricky when I have like four people that are out with sick kids, you know, it's on a team of 15 or 20 people. It's very challenging.
Yeah.
I think you've got to cross train. I think you've got to have really flexible people who can fill in a lot of different pieces. So, you know, you have to scope roles in a very different way, I think. Mm-hmm. You've got to be an excellent communicator. And, but I think, I guess I don't understand people that don't care about, they don't want to be bothered with who their people are sort of in totality, because I wanted to be seen that way. You know, I always felt that a conventional relationship with my employer was like a horribly confining. And I remember that feeling, and I'll never forget it. You know, I felt like a cog in the wheel, and I felt judged. I didn't feel valued for my particular genius. And that made me leave. I mean, it made me sort of run screaming. And I don't know if anybody knew that until it was too late, but I don't want to only know when it's too late. And I guess if you go to the trouble of hiring people and attracting them to your organization and onboarding them, people have to remember it costs, I think the stat is 3 times somebody's annual salary to have them leave. And leave they will if we don't get this piece right. So I think, I don't know if we have a choice.
That's, you know, that's what I always say it boils down to, Jennifer. It's like, this is like, you have to ask yourself if you have a long-term or short-term strategic vision of your employees. Because mm-hmm. in the short term, you can pound work out of them, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can mm-hmm. definitely just get the, you know, aggressive whipping post mindset and just bang, 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 like, you know, 14, 16 hours working weekend, like crush, crush, crush. But you'll burn them out. They'll feel like you don't care. And you'll have to hire more people, which to your point, it is so time consuming and costly. The long-term investment into the people's lives. And first of all, it's more enjoyable for you. They're real people. You get to like have conversations, like you can right? actually enjoy each other. I knew every story about every employee in my business of, you know, 50 people at one point and, you know, their kids and like their, whatever's going on with them. But also my most junior person when I left was, you know, 9 years with me, right? So you just don't have to go through the struggle. If you've been in business and you've lost somebody and had to replace them, it is so, you are so right. You know, it's got such a diminishing return. So
it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah. We do things for each other. I mean, we fill in for each other. There's the goodwill that you just can't put a price tag on. And I love it. And I want my folks to be like brainstorming and giving their, what we call, I like to call it the discretionary effort. You know, that's what I think a lot of large anonymous companies leave on the table is people's extra effort that they can choose to do with what they will, right? So some people take that outside of the organization or who pays their bills and they give it to a nonprofit. They do it in their community activism. They have a business on the side of your business.
So they're like grinding for you, but they're passionate elsewhere.
Like what's the point of that? And I think if we can tap into people's shared purpose and their want to be there and their want to be doing that work, that's just critical. It just unlocks so much. And I can't do it all myself. There's no way as the founder, I'm going to come up with all the ideas that I need. And so, you know, if I'm just grinding, like you said, and, you know, people look at it as a paycheck, there's no way I'm going to be innovating my way, you know, as quickly as I can, as effectively as I can. And I need all that brain power, but I need the heart power. You know, I need people to care because we do our best thinking, I think, when we're sort of 120% in. And when I think about the leakiness in so many organizations and leaking that effort because companies don't care, as to me, such an inefficiency. And if we could quantify that, we'd be horrified at the drag on the bottom line. But I just don't know if we have the tools to really nail it down in a spreadsheet, you know, and it's so squishy. It's so squishy. I mean, Google gives people, you know, a day. They used to give people a day a week. I'm sure they're all workaholics, just like all of us are. But theoretically, they give people time to go and just ideate, to go and do your, you know, do your you time and self-care. And, you know, they believe that people are going to be sort of more balanced when they return to the task.
Right. Because then they can problem solve and they can innovate because, you know, I mean, my innovations come in the shower on a walk.
Yes.
Right?
They're not exactly.
Staring at the computer. I'm like, that's right. So this podcast ultimately is about having success and authenticity, which is obviously something that you've spent a lot of time thinking about and living and breathing. So what does an authentic life then mean to you?
An authentic life is a truthful life. It's a life where you spend a minimal amount of time managing or putting energy towards what's not true and doesn't resonate with you. And it's putting yourself first. And I might say, as a woman, I think that is more difficult for some of us than others. I think when you are different, it's a longer road towards that authenticity, I'd say, because we have so many voices in our head and we are so conditioned to feel less than, and we see so many fewer role models as we were talking about earlier. So, but the journey of fighting for authenticity and fighting for truth and alignment of who we are and what we do and create in the world, that journey is, boy, I am really so grateful that I was forced to undertake it. Mm. And when I say forced, I was, I mean, whether it was losing my voice, literally, which, you know, I'm no dummy. That was definitely a message from somewhere, you know, use it or lose it. But we don't mean, you know, by singing an aria, but I think also being LGBT and fighting around that to say, you know, how am I going to bring that into the world and what are the risks and how do I muster up the courage to be true to myself at the end of the day and let kind of the chips fall. Yeah. And I think if we all had the courage and the mentorship and support to undertake that journey, we would all be not only happier, but I think more successful. We would see more creativity in the world. We would be able to come from a place of love because we've actually loved ourselves first. And I think that's just ultimately made, I know it's made me a better leader to have to fight for what does that mean for me and undergo the risks of it and build the muscle around authenticity that now I feel like I, you know, lucky me, you know, I get to be my own boss, you know, and I understand that that's a level of privilege that I have, but God knows, you know, owning your own business cannot, sometimes does not feel like a privilege. Definitely not. But it's just made me a better leader to have to fight for all those things. And then for me to be able to then be in the business of talking about our authentic stories and everything, of course, I've walked that walk. And, you know, you are listened to in a different way. And I think your power comes across so differently when you have actually walked that journey. And I get sad for people that are sort of following a formulaic life. You know, they are doing the job they think they should do. They're marrying the person they think they should. They maybe they're closeted because, you know, their families. And it just makes me sad because we may never know their brilliance and we may never know what they could have brought into the world. And God knows our world needs all of us right now. So oof. I think that's where we need to go.
I love it.
That's it in a nutshell.
In a nutshell, crushed it. And just a follow-up point to that incredibly beautiful and so well articulated view, finding your power, stepping forward, putting yourself first, loving yourself. So many people then say it's selfish, especially women, right? Mm. So mm-hmm. how do you answer for those people out there that are struggling with that line, right? Of where, how do I put myself first, but not feel selfish? When is it selfish and when is it stepping into your own life?
Yeah. And there's such a double standard about this, right? That's very gendered.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we need, if you're in a heterosexual paradigm in your life, you know, you need a full partner. You know, Sheryl Sandberg writes about her partner, husband, now deceased, sadly, but in Lean In, she talks a lot about what she's been able to do because of that partnership. And yes, she is a very successful and very wealthy white woman, you know, and we've been around and around about that unintentional bias that she has and that's her experience. But the more deeper point about it is your partner, whatever gender they are, whatever kind of relationship you're in, or even if you don't have a partner, it is fighting for that time in your schedule to restore and to, you know, refocus and to do that self-care. And trust me, I mean, I felt like I built my business according to what maybe the male paradigm expected it to be for a long time, for many years. And I had men kind of in my ear telling me, whether it was my old CFOs that I had or executive mentors or mentoring groups I was in, where it was all men that owned businesses and me. It's interesting. You just get this diet of expectation.
Do.
Yeah. And you know this. And I had to separate myself from that and intentionally seek communities of women business owners and women in sort of more that, frankly, the spiritual conversation, because I needed to fill and replace that dialogue and narrative with what is true for me? What kind of business do I want to build? What kind of life do I want to architect for myself? And whether we call it feminine or not, it is just that I think we just get indoctrinated and we have to separate ourselves from that and say, what's going to be meaningful to me? And when men look at businesses, they think, oh, when am I going to maybe sell it? You know, what is it right. worth? You know, how turn and burn or, uh-huh. you know, the metric is so different. The metric of growth, the metric of success. Uh-huh. So, you know, I think we need to watch for all those things and create intentional space for us to say, what do I want my legacy to be? What is going to be the best business model for me, not what everybody else says it is? And what kind of leader, not am I told to be, but that I feel authentically with no shoulds. You know, the shoulds is so intense. It's so bad. And, you know, I just was made to feel like I wasn't a good leader, really. And I wasn't trusting my intuition for years. You know, I would go externally and get that advice and try it on for size or lead from it and then be called inauthentic by the people that I was trying so desperately to lead. And I think that I had to really make a shift around that. So I do think we just need to create some kind of new narrative about leading as a woman. And what does that mean? And maybe that means a lot of different leadership styles. We just need more choices about what works for us and not just one way.
And that last sentence, I think, is the critical piece. What works for us? Everybody is a little different. Even, mm-hmm. you know, you break it down by male, female, but then even within women, there's different ideas. Mm-hmm. And until you get really honest with yourself and start that process from your own truth, it's very hard to move forward because it just then becomes some amalgamation of a whole bunch of other people's truths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And somebody else's voice and not yours. And I think that's, women have to solve for that. And we've got to put 15, you know, safeguards in place around us at all times in order to build new habits. And it's small things, it's big things, it's daily things. It's, you know, pay attention.
So what are your daily habits and practices?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that. Oh, yes. Well, I'm not like, I will admit, I grab my coffee cup and I go to the computer and I just, you know, I could work a 14-hour day and still be in my PJs at 8 o'clock at night. So that is my life. But some of my bigger rituals, I think, are I take time to just not always think about what's the bottom line ROI for all the things I do. But sometimes I do things to just be in the audience, to soak up the energy and to listen to different kinds of leaders. You know, I make a lot of time to go to women's conferences where I can hear a different narrative. That's really important to me, not to always be presenting, although I love presenting at those things too. You know, it's, mm-hmm. I think my story actually has to be heard by a lot more women mm-hmm. too. And I bring that whole intersectional piece too, as an LGBT woman. And that's even a piece that I think can be transformative for not just LGBT people, but a lot of others. But I will get on a plane and I will put myself in these different spaces so that I can be challenged and kind of make a paradigm shift. And it's a shift away from maybe the male conversation or the business, the corporate world. I've had such a steady diet of corporate for 10 years and I'm really fascinated with my journey of more of what we're talking about today. So I've been working on a personal website in addition to my business website, and it's going to be different. It's going to be, if you read my book now that I just wrote, maybe my second book's going to be much more about a personal journey and mm-hmm. maybe of uncovering my gifts and my truth and finding a job or a career or a calling rather that, you know, how did I get there? Because you know, I think that I'm not sure that has to do with diversity, which is what I'm known for, but it's what I feel very on a personal level is what I think is that meaningful piece. And it's what your podcast is all about, Laura. It's like, you know, how can we show more? Like, here's what it looks like. And I'm not on the tail end. I'm still evolving. However, I think it's so critical to show myself where I am in my journey and where I'm not in my journey. You know, warts and all, to young women, for example, and young leaders that don't see themselves.
Yeah,
to me, that is meaningful.
Yeah, who think when you get to the moment of stature that you've made it and you feel amazing and you're waking up dancing every day. Like that, you know, we're all in a process. We're all in a journey. And Carl Jung says it's a privilege of a lifetime to find out who you really are. And I think it's a lifetime. Yeah.
I love that. And I think giving back is so healing for me. I have to say, just seeing the mentoring a younger generation that won't make the same mistakes that I did or will be able to get to their authenticity quicker. If I can be a part of that, that sort of recenters me and reminds me why I do what I do. Yeah, so I would do that all day long if I could.
I know. And they're open to it, which is amazing.
I know.
Our generation was like, go make money, get a job. Stop talking.
It's true. It's true. Too late for us.
we're coming around. You know, I feel like my work is helping people who are in a midlife crisis who came from just like make money and then and now they're like, oh my god, what it was
oh my
the
god.
Mean
or no.
And the younger ones, it's preventative life crisis. Like I'm like,
that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, it's like do it now so you don't have to end up there.
Yeah,
Jennifer, this was amazing. Thank you so much for coming show, sharing your story. Sure. If people are interested in hearing more about you or buying your book, where can they find you?
Yeah. So I'll tell you, the book is on Amazon. So please buy it there. It's called Inclusion, : diversity, the new workplace, and the will to change, which is that favorite part at the end there, that will to change piece. I am also going to have a podcast, Laura, as I was sharing with you, in the new year. So we're starting our interviews now, and we're going to have some really interesting people on there. And I won't say more than that, but it is about the will to change. And then I am on Twitter. I'm super active on Twitter. And, you know, apologies for anyone that's not very political, but I'm pretty activist on there. I'm pretty opinionated. It's at Jennifer Brown. I've been on there for a long time, so I got that handle, which is kind of amazing. And then we're on LinkedIn, we're on Facebook. And if anyone needs to reach me about speaking engagements or bulk orders of the book, if you want to bring me in, et cetera, just send us an email at info@jenniferbrownconsulting.com. And then please give my TED Talks a watch. There's the one I was referring to is TEDx Presidio, and it's on YouTube. And it's a great 8-minute watch.
It really is great. I watched it. Thank you. Thank you. Run out, buy her book, listen to her. Oh, she's got a lot to say and so much value. Yeah. Thank you for the work you're doing.
I appreciate this opportunity. Thanks so much. And thanks to your audience today.
Thank you so much for tuning in. And I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Hey, before you go, I have a quick question for you. Have you ever considered coaching? If you have no idea what coaching is, no worries. It's basically like a personalized workout program, but instead of doing 100 squats and a million sit-ups, you're working out your mind, your well-being, and your emotions. Coaching is about setting goals and taking action to create a life that's meaningful to you. As we navigate through life and ask ourselves the tough questions, what do I want? What makes me happy? How do I build a life that works for me? Just like we talk about on the podcast, how do I have success, but have success that's authentic and meaningful? In part, the tactics play a huge role. Setting goals, having priorities that make sense, and making sure you're organized with your lists. After running a company for 15 years, I help my clients with that all the time. But coaching takes it even further. We remove all that stuff, all those mental obstacles that get in your way when you're trying to make those tough life choices. If that sounds interesting to you, come on over to lauraco.com, click on the contact form and send me a note, or at the bottom of the homepage, you'll see a button where you can click and set up a call with me. Just like that, it's free. We'll chat, we'll find out what's going on and see if it makes sense for me to help you out. No strings attached. I hope to hear from you. And again, thank you so much for tuning in. I really value each and every one of you.